You're listening to an ESA podcast brought to you by the Ecological Society of America. ESA, promoting the science of ecology.
I'm Piper Corp, and this is The Ecologist Goes to Washington, a podcast program of the Ecological Society of America, where I interview scientists who are involved in ecological policy issues. Today, I'm interviewing Dr. Rick Hoiber, former Associate Director of ESA's Sustainable Biosphere Initiative Project Office, who now leads the Assessment and Communications Branch of the U.S. Environment Protection Agency's Clean Air Markets Division. Dr. Hoiber also serves on ESA's Public Affairs Committee. So your educational background is in the social sciences, and you received your PhD in international studies. How did you become interested in ecology and policy?
Well, it started in grad school. I was studying international studies and international relations, political science, and I became interested in environmental policy, and I realized that if I was going to have an interest in environmental policy, that I needed to take some courses in environmental science, which I had not done in undergrad. And so I took courses in ecology, environmental health sciences, environmental risk assessment, that sort of thing. For my dissertation, I looked at forestry policy in India, the colonial forestry policy versus independent Indian forestry policy, and what the impact on India's forest resources were. And so that sort of started my real serious interest in environmental policy and ecology, really.
And with the blend of social sciences and environmental science and policy, what are some of the advantages and challenges from having such a unique blend of perspectives?
Well, I think the advantages are that I see the world in a different way because of my training than somebody would who has just a degree in natural or physical sciences. And that, in fact, I think was one of the reasons why I was hired at ESA to be associate director of what was then the Sustainable Biosphere Initiative Project Office and has since become the science office. But one of the challenges is that not having a real background in science, I've had to pick up a lot of what I know on the fly. And so I really am indebted to the many members of ESA who, over the 7 years that I worked for ESA, were willing to, you know, sort of take my questions seriously and help me understand things, because without that tutelage on the part of many really wonderful, noble ESA members, I would be still an ignorant political scientist.
You are a congressional fellow in the office of Senator Carper. How would you characterize the role of science on the Hill?
One of many inputs. I think that a lot of times folks feel that science should inform policy, and I believe that's true. But I think often people who say that feel that science should be the basis of policy. And it's really only going to be one of many inputs, along with politics, of course, economics, the constraints of society at any point in time. And it's important for people to understand that science is an input, but only one of many, and to not get frustrated if they feel the policy that comes out after they've weighed in is not identical to what they thought it should be.
So there's been a lot of talk about a carbon cap and trade program coming into fruition under the next administration. And at EPA, you work in the Clean Air Markets Division. So how might you and your division be involved in the development of this kind of program?
That really depends upon a number of decisions that have yet to be sorted out. So if we end up with a change in policy in terms of greenhouse gas emissions in the next administration, which remains to be seen, and if there is a cap and trade program versus some other way of addressing greenhouse gases, and if a cap and trade program were to come to EPA as opposed to Department of Energy or some other agency, these are all big ifs, and if that cap and trade program dealt with the fossil fuel burning electric power industry, which is the sources we control here where I work, then possibly the division that I work in might be very closely involved in designing and then administering a cap and trade program. What we do here in the Clean Air Markets Division is design and implement cap and trade programs. The first being the acid rain program, which involved trading of SO2 emissions allowances. The second program was the NOx budget trading program, which focused on controlling NOx emissions to address ground level ozone issues during the ozone season. So we've got experience with two different trading programs here in this group of 65 or 70 people that I work in. But there are all of those ifs and unknowns, so it's an open question. But we hope that we'll be intimately involved.
Within the Clean Air Markets Division, you lead the Assessment and Communications Branch, which determines and communicates the costs and benefits of the division's programs to decision makers. So what kinds of disciplines are represented in your branch, and how do you facilitate effective communication between experts from the different fields?
I have in my branch a wide range of disciplines. There's 15 of us. I've got a guy with a PhD in organic chemistry, somebody with a PhD in zoology, somebody with a PhD in ecology and evolutionary biology, somebody with a bachelor's in environmental policy and science, a guy with a degree in computer science, as well as he's just finishing up a master's in public policy from Georgetown. It's a really wide variety of disciplines. How do I get them to communicate effectively? You know, I'm a very hands-off manager. I try and work with folks to set a vision for what we need to do and let them sort of self-organize. And so far, it's worked out pretty well. I find that people find each other in order to solve the questions that get asked. They come up with very creative answers and very creative ways of looking at data. So it's a wide group of people, and I just sort of, step back and get out of the way.
So the common goal drives cooperation?
Yeah, they know that our job as the assessment and communications group is to basically tell stories about the programs that we implement. You know, so we need to be able to tell the public and others in the agency about how those programs work, what the results are, what problems are left on the table, and to do that in ever more sophisticated ways while still being able to communicate in that complexity in a way that's clear enough for, you know, my mom and your mom to understand.
What are some of the strategies you use for packaging the information so it will be useful and understandable?
Mapping. You know, I think that the old adage, you know, a picture is worth a thousand words is really, really quite true. So out of the 15 people, 10 are either truly experts or quite well trained in GIS. So being able to take data and present it visually, knowing that underneath that graphic display, there's a huge amount of complexity that the people who look at it don't ever need to understand and will never understand, but just in looking at two before and after pictures, which we do frequently, pictures of deposition, for example, before and after the program, it's just an amazing visual display of the changes that have resulted as the consequence of the program that we implement.
Throughout your career, you've championed environmental monitoring. In which of your positions did you feel you had the greatest opportunity to move the initiative forward?
Right where I'm at now. I interact a lot with monitoring networks and the monitoring community. I feel like I have a great opportunity to showcase the use of monitoring for looking at programs and understanding environmental change and the importance of those networks and the data that they gather.
What are some of the biggest obstacles you've run into?
Some of the biggest obstacles, as always, is funding. You know, monitoring is often, I've heard this many times over the years, it's the last thing to get funded and the first thing to get cut. So it's funding, it's how you make people see the need for the data. Monitoring is not necessarily sexy. And so how do you make it that? How do you make it something that grabs attention and keeps people's attention? Those are important obstacles.
In terms of professional relationships, which ones have been the most valuable as you've supported environmental monitoring?
I would say that the professional relationships that are probably most important are the people that I met in my 7 years at ESA. Those relationships that in some cases are now, you know, 10 or 15 years old have been critical for me both in terms of furthering the use of the monitoring data in the scientific community as well as for policy and program assessment and analysis and reporting results. And also those folks have been critical, I think, as a conduit from here in the agency to say these networks are important. You know, you and the scientific community realize the importance of monitoring and the monitoring networks, and so you have to raise your voices too. Within the agencies, we can't be the only ones saying, because it seems self-serving. We're the ones who run the networks in many cases, and so it's self-serving for us to be the only ones communicating the importance of them. So having those folks on the outside who also see the need for the monitoring, the networks, the data, and are able to make the case in the broader scientific community and to other folks, other stakeholders, is really crucial. So that's been fantastic, having those relationships with people that I met through ESA and have nurtured those relationships over the years.
That was Rick Hoiber from the U.S. Environmental Protection Agency. Thanks so much for listening, and please join us next time on The Ecologist Goes to Washington.
This podcast has been brought to you by the Ecological Society of America. Music was provided by Dr. Nicholas Catelli. For a link to Dr. Catelli's homepage, more information about ESA, or additional podcasts, please visit www.esa.org. Thanks for listening.